It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
On Commons People this week...
As the ruins of Carillion lie around her, will the Prime Minister act to end this costly racket?
Carillion collapses. Does the government have questions to answer about the failing firm?
I've dreamt for a members-led Labour Party, and I think that's what I hope we're going to get.
Is it the end for centrist dads as momentum sweep to power on Labour's NEC?
A young woman has been effectively exploited by my political enemies who feel that they can't challenge me in open political debate.
And the UKIP leader's relationship status changes to it's complicated. All of this and more on Commons People. Hello and welcome to Commons People, HuffPost UK's politics podcast. With me, Owen Bennett, and I'm joined this week by Kate Forrester. Hello, Kate.
Hello.
Mr. Paul Wall, how are you?
Hi there.
And Ned Symonds is here as well.
Hello.
Hello, Ned. How are you?
Not bad. How are you?
Good. Very good. Thank you. Very good. Let's crack on. The outsourcing and construction giant Carillion, which employs around 20,000 people, went into liquidation this week. It has public sector or public/private partnership contracts worth a staggering £1.7 billion and held 450 contracts with the government. The group's massive portfolio includes providing school dinners, cleaning and catering at NHS hospitals, building HS2, maintaining 50,000 army base homes for the MOD, but it's been struggling under £900 million of debt and a £587 million pension deficit. Here's Jeremy Corbyn discussing the matter at PMQs.
These corporations, Mr. Speaker, need to be shown the door. Yeah. We need our public services provided by public employees with a public service ethos and a strong public oversight. As the ruins of Carillion lie around her, will the Prime Minister act to end this costly racket of the relationship between government and some of these companies?
And here's Theresa May's response.
The Right Honourable Gentleman said earlier in one of his questions it was the government's job to ensure that Carillion was properly managed. We were a customer of Carillion, not the manager of Carillion. And that's a very important difference. And it is also important, that we have protected taxpayers from an unacceptable bailout of a private company.
So Theresa May there saying it's not the government's fault, we're just customers. And Corbyn saying, show all these private companies the door. I feel like they're quite extreme positions, both of them. I feel like saying something to do with us and get rid of everyone. Is that, Ned, is that too extreme? Is that where we are now?
Well, I think it's quite good for Corbyn, isn't it? Because obviously May's argument is, well, a lot of these deals were done under Labour, but no one can accuse Jeremy Corbyn of being part of the last Labour government.
I don't remember him standing up from the backbench making massive interventions in favour of PFI.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So if anything, the fact that the Prime Minister's saying, well, we were doing this and so was Blair and Brown, it kind of accentuates Corbyn's kind of anti-establishment position, doesn't it? He's saying, I'm not just against the Conservatives, I'm against this entire consensus of PFI and everything that was going on completely. So politically, it's quite a nice moment for him, I think, if the actual what's going on isn't so great.
And I think that actually is a good point about clear red water, Labour and the Tories on this. That's what Corbyn wants. He wants, you know, yet again, whether on austerity or on lots of other areas, you know where Labour now stands is the message. It's really clear. Tories like public-private partnerships, Labour don't like them. And John McDonnell, to his credit, at last party conference, sort of flagged a lot of these issues up and said, look, you know, we want to take back in-house as much as we can. Now, obviously, there was a garble at the time about how much they could afford and whether or not it was feasible, but at least they were politically in the right territory. They didn't know this was coming down the track. If they had, I think they would have made even more capital. But the point is that Corbyn, yes, has always been against PFIs and PPPs, public-private partnerships, just as Ken Livingstone was for the London Underground way back in 1999 and 2000. The tube now that everyone rides on in London, if you live in London, you know, has got these brand new trains, new facilities. Now, that's all done through a private finance initiative. It's been hugely expensive, but the risk was borne by the private sector. At the time, Livingstone said something that everyone thought was really radical. He said, well, you don't need to do this. He was trying to persuade New Labour and Stephen Byres, the Transport Secretary, you don't need to do this. We can have the state do this at very low interest rates because we're going to issue special bonds and the government will guarantee them. So we can get all this investment, but the state will guarantee it. That's a better way. Now, he was ignored by New Labour, and obviously the Tories under Cameron continued this kind of thing. But it's worth going back to when Labour started PFI and continued Major's PFI. It was Lord Lawson who reminded everyone on Monday that actually he was dead against it. He didn't think it was a very conservative thing to do because he thought that it would reward big business, not small business. It would take off, it was a bit of a con because it took off the public balance sheet, all these real spending liabilities. And he felt that overall it wouldn't work. And we've got a curious situation now where you've got Jeremy Corbyn and Nigel Lawson in agreement on public
Nigel
policy.
Lawson, of course, Chancellor under Margaret Thatcher. Kate, what do you think this says for the Tories? Because Labour are out there still of what they would do, what they believe politically, where they ideologically sit, where they practically sit. I've not heard a big defence this week for PFI. I mean, I guess this week of all weeks, you wouldn't hear it, but then this week of all weeks, maybe you need it the most. Why aren't the Tories getting out there and trying to defend this system and just say this is just a rogue thing, this is a one-off, whatever?
I think it's quite hard to argue with the sentiment that Corbyn's put forward this week about, you know, the hundreds of small firms that are now facing ruin, who are tied into contracts with Carillion and stuff. I think it's still quite an emotional issue at the moment because loads of people are being quite seriously affected by it. The Tories' kind of main defence or main sort of good point that they're trying to push appears to be, oh well, we've not given the green light to a public bailout of Carillion. It's like, oh, okay, great, that's good, but yeah, we've not seen a huge defence, and I guess maybe that's because at the moment it feels a bit, it might be a bit raw, it might look a bit insensitive maybe, given the sort of impact it's had.
It's funny that we didn't even, I just think for years now the Tories, I think that's the referendum campaign for example, I know that wasn't the Tories particularly stronger in, they didn't want to take the fight on immigration to the anti-EU people. I feel like it's an argument they couldn't win. I feel like with the economy as well, they don't want to take the fight to Labour to it. Why do the Tories keep ducking these things?
Well, you can see why. If you've got a massive collapse like this week, it's not good for the brand, shall we say, for public-private partnerships. What that perhaps they ought to be saying, and maybe Philip Hammond will be doing this next week, is saying the benefits of these things, which is that, you know, the private sector takes a lot of the risk. If things go wrong, then they get hammered, you know, and it's been proved it, you know, no public money has been lost. It's the private sector and all those shareholders that are losing out through this collapse. And so they might get on the front foot a bit more next week saying, actually, this proves why this is actually quite good for the taxpayer. They take the risk and they take the fall. But I think that I was listening this week on Monday to a select committee where we had two very senior Sir Humphreys. You had Cabinet Secretary Jeremy Hayward and you had John Manzoni, head of the Cabinet Office, who were both quizzed in detail about what happened in Carillion. And the way they spun it, they were incredibly dismissive, if not defensive, about this whole collapse. But they were saying that somehow the public sector has finally got its act together. It's worked how to do these contracts. It's worked how to make sure that we don't lose out if things go wrong. And Hayward conceded 10 years ago the public sector was nowhere near in that position. Even 2 years ago, Manzoni said we wouldn't have been able to do this kind of thing. But Manzoni then came out with some line that if he'd been a politician would have been hammered by. He said that the civil servant in charge of Carillion had, quotes, played a blinder. And Paul Flynn, you know, was quick as a flash, said, you mean played a blinder as in had their eyes covered up? And the civil servant got a bit irked. And he said, no, I meant played a blinder because the civil servant actually put in place all these joint ventures to make sure that there were other people after the prophet's warning for Carillion, that if things were going wrong, at least there was some safety mechanism to make sure it didn't affect everyone.
Well, let's talk about those joint ventures, because that's been the government's defence on this, is that since the government guidance is when a company issues a profit warning, you start giving them contracts, right? Because you start thinking this company might not be around for much longer, okay? But Carillion offered profit warnings. They were given more contracts. Joint ventures, so the idea, as Paul said, is if one half of one company involved falls apart, the company picks it up. But there was one contract that was given after the profit warning, which wasn't a joint venture. So is the question to ask now, the suggestion is the government would try to put work Carillion's way to keep it going, to keep it look like a viable company?
Yeah, that is what people are asking. It might be also plays into the idea of there's now a lot of companies where they're the only company that can do it. If you look at the same things with G4S, Serco, these massive companies where if they're not given the work, there's no one else to do it. If look at the Olympics when G4S messed up the security and the army had to step in because there wasn't another company the government could go to do that job. So I think that's why Corbyn's bringing up those particular firms that are kind of too big to fail, as it were.
And do you think that there's, just following this, that there's a whole generation of people who became politically aware, politically mature, if you like, during the financial crash and on the wake of the financial crash, and all they see is actually big business getting all the profits, the public sector taking all the risk, actually, and the government just have to step whenever it fails. And actually, that there is a kind of change in the mentality now, people, as there was in 45 and as there was in 79, and now we're seeing it again now, that actually people do not just accept as read this kind of economic orthodoxy.
Yeah, and if you think back to the Tory party conference in October, Theresa May was making this kind of point that she conceded that Jeremy Corbyn had changed the economic consensus in the country. And her argument was, we need to fight back against that because he's wrong. But we've not actually seen, like you said, Owen, we've not seen them fight back. We've not seen them make the case for why the kind of changing consensus about the public sector has happened. And it's because of the financial crisis, particularly amongst young people who are kind of 30 and below, who did grow up in the financial crisis.
And I think that overall, Corbyn is trying to push this idea that, look, we should reverse the way we think. For years it's been public bad, private good. He wants it to be switched right around, public good, private bad. But the one person this week, it wasn't the Tories who was defending private sector involvement in public services. It was an old Blairite, Phil Wilson, MP for Sedgefield, who succeeded Tony Blair. And he was in the Myland Institute in the East End of the university there as part of John Rentoul's sort of exploration of new Labour. And this is one of five guys who got Tony Blair selected for that seat in Sedgefield. He's got a role in history, no question, and he succeeded him. And Phil Wilson said, look, as far as he's concerned, when Blair introduced private treatment centres for the NHS, there was lots of sort of, shock horror amongst them on the left. He said, but it delivered results because it brought in extra capacity the NHS couldn't deal with. So he said he was on the doorstep knocking one of his constituents and a woman had an eye patch and he said, oh, what's happened? And she said, I've just been at a cataract operation. And it was done in record quick time. And he said, there's a really good example, a working class constituent who got a public service thanks to an extra capacity from the private sector. No one on Labour's benches is making that case other than Phil Wilson right now.
And it's moved to Labour now as Jeremy Corbyn backing group Momentum have swept to power on Labour's ruling National Executive Committee. Paul, you've been following this story and it seems that within, minutes, seconds, hours of taking control, there was controversy over the disciplinary panel that makes up how Labour looks into things, anti-Semitism and stuff. Just talk us through that.
Well, yeah, there was. I mean, what happened this week was that the NEC got three brand new extra local party members and Momentum candidates swept the board, including founder John Landsman, and they filled those new three slots. The very next day, the NEC met properly for the first time since its new 39-strong body was created. And straight away, Momentum basically flexed its muscles. And the long-serving chair of the disputes panel, called Anne Black, who's a soft left candidate and has always been backed for many, many years by the left, suddenly Momentum turned against her and said, look, actually, your time's up. We need someone called Christine Shawcroft, who's also another veteran left-winger, to replace you. Now, the real reason, it's not without getting to all the processology, the real reason they did this is that they felt that actually it was, quote, time for a change, and that there'd been some simmering sort of resentment about Anne Black's role in excluding party members from the leadership contest in 2016. And to be honest, anyone who's in charge of disputes, the committee in Labour Party, is always going to get lots of brickbats because there's lots of internal battles, there's lots of rows of, is it right or is it wrong for someone to have said something that was allegedly racist, allegedly anti-Semitic, allegedly homophobic or sexist? Are there any defences? Is it being used as a purge or a witch hunt against someone on the left, the language they're using? Or is it legitimate? Are these people real scumbags and need kicking out? So whoever's in charge of that process is always going to get a kicking. And it happened to be Anne Black that finally, it was payback time, it seemed, this week. But I think the overall, what was significant was that, you remember when Neil Kinnock said, when Ed Miliband got the Labour leadership. He said, we've got our party back. A lot of people, the Blairites, felt, well, actually, be careful what you wish for, because what's happened since is that the left really think they've got their party back. And on the NEC, they're really going to show how that really is the case now.
Kate, you come from that bastion of left-wing hotbed political activity of Merseyside, which is very famous, of course, in the 80s, having a militant council there. There's a perception, like you said, that Paul said there, of the left having the party back. What's that going to mean practically then? How does that change anything? Does it not change anything at all?
Well, I suppose the next stage is whether they look seriously at reselections of MPs, which is obviously going to be the next kind of massive hurdle. I think some people are sort of expecting it. Some people say that it's definitely, you know, they're not going to go that far. It's not going to happen. I think from a few MPs that I've spoken to, the most worrying aspect of this is that a lot of them are still getting a lot of abuse, and they've stopped coming forward with it now because I guess they don't want to look like they're kind of making a big deal and constantly complaining. But there's a lot of them who are still receiving quite serious threats. Some of them are receiving anti-Semitic abuse. And I guess the real test of the new makeup of the NEC is how they're going to deal with that as well.
And then what sense do you get of the appetite for deselections, reselections? I mean, there's been some selections of parliamentary candidates already. As a candidate in Corby, a woman called Beth Miller. She's not.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? There was a couple of stories around this week after the NEC results about how, whilst momentum kind of does now have a grip at the centre, but a lot of the parliamentary selections, they're not winning those selections. So it tends to be people who've been around for a long time in the constituencies, who have more personal relationships, who know the local activists, who are getting selected to be the MPs, not the kind of new momentum left-wing candidates. So it's interesting, I think, to watch over the next few years if momentum can push on from the NEC and the centre of the party now, or are they now the establishment? And weirdly, kind of the in the country, you've got the kind of people who still don't agree with them and are still getting the seats and the MPs.
It's true. I mean, in the recent rush of parliamentary reselections, because Corbyn, don't forget, wants to get all these people in place in case there's a snap election. He wants candidates in place really early, even though there might not be an election until 2022. He wants them in. Six out of the 23 selections that have taken place so far, only six have gone to momentum-backed candidates. That's about just less than a quarter, just over a quarter. And I was talking earlier this week to people who are in the sort of centrist wing of the party, and they were saying the real reason for that is because, as Ned says, it's about personal relationships, long-term relationships, activists, and the fact that, unlike NEC elections, which are all online and you could just click a button, this involves turning up in person, it involves actually meeting people, it means being on the ground regularly. And obviously a lot of momentum people are starting to do that now. There are a lot of really big local meetings taking place, but it so far hasn't materialised into reselections that are in momentum's favour.
And just finally on this, what does the Blairite wing need to do now? Because the Blairite wing, the Progress wing, the centrist wing, whatever you want to call it, have spent, since Corbyn's been elected, as far as I can tell, basically having a whinge, right? And not really actually putting together a coherent vision of what they want Labour to be, what they wanted to do, how they wanted to run the country. It's just been, you lot are unelectable. And then the general election shows, even though they didn't win, it was more popular than they thought. Isn't it time for the Progress lot to start doing something a bit positive?
Yeah, I think so. I think before they're waiting, particularly with the snap election, the assumption that Corbyn and then his side of the party would lose, and that would in itself prove why Progress and the so-called right were correct. Obviously that didn't happen, so I think, you know, if there's not an election till 2022 now, perhaps they need to kind of still make their case but come up with a new programme for a few years down the line, rather than just, like you say, look like they're whinging.
They don't really yet have the sort of intellectual heft either that they've previously used to have. They haven't made any big arguments in terms of policy, any terms of how does the left of centre, whether it's the centre left or whether it's the further out left, how does it cope with this massive problem of globalisation and delivering for ordinary people? How do you correct a lot of those imbalances, the inequalities? How do you do it? And very few people have come up with the answers. Jeremy Corbyn's got one very clear answer, which is a lot more state control. But for people in the centre-left of Labour, it's been much more difficult.
And also, I think, whilst obviously it's the most important thing that's happened to the country for a long time, I think a lot of the perhaps intellectual side of the right have been distracted, for want of a better word, by Brexit.
Yeah,
so their definitely. Time is going into arguing internal fights about staying the single market and the customs union, rather than thinking of domestic politics about how the economy works. And that's where they're focused, perhaps having given up on the rest of it.
And in a way, I think both sides are going to wait for Brexit to get out of the way before this battle starts again.
And so we shall keep an eye on that, as always. Now, earlier this year, I went over to Iceland. Just because it seemed like a nice place to go. And I spoke to some people there, because Iceland's not in the EU, but it's in EFTA, and I spoke to some people there to get their views on Brexit. Here's my little report. I'm here in downtown Reykjavik, January the 1st, 2018. I was supposed to be in my holidays, but I thought I couldn't come to a country like Iceland, which is in EFTA, which is perhaps one of the things the UK could be joining, without speaking to some of the locals here to find out their view of the EU, of Brexit, and frankly, whether they give a damn. So here's the first guy I spoke to, who works in a tourist office. What has people in Iceland made of Brexit? Has that registered at all here? Are people aware that Brexit's going on?
Oh, I think we're aware, yes. And I think we look at it like in a, I don't know, like a negative-ish light.
Okay.
But then we are not part of the European Union. So, I don't know, like, I feel like the one, I know quite a few Brits I worked with abroad and stuff, and they're all, like, seems to be the young people are more against it.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, yeah, I don't think it was a good thing to do.
And obviously, you, like you said, you guys aren't part of the EU, but you're part of EFTA, so you have some arrangements with the EU.
Yeah.
There's lots of talk that Britain could join that model. Would you recommend that? Is that a good thing to join?
I have no idea like how that works really, so I can't really comment on that. But I'm sure you could join that, yeah, and be part of the trade commitment or whatever it is.
And what's the view of the EU from Iceland? Because obviously the EU would quite like Iceland to be a full member so they can get hold of your fishing. I think that's one of the big things that they want. And obviously you guys are like, no, that's a big part of our economy. So do people view the EU with a bit of suspicion here? Or
I think it's a pretty 50-50, but the more against the EU for that reasons. But also, like, we have to take, like, the krona, the currency we have, is, like, people have doubts about that in the future. So joining EU, we could take up the euro. But then again, there's all this trouble with the EU.
I then decided to pop into a place which sold a lot of Icelandic wool, which, believe me, you need here because it does get very, very cold. I spoke to this guy, Viking, to see what he made of it. So obviously, as you know, at the moment we're going through Brexit in the UK. And obviously Iceland is not part of the EU, but it's in EFTA. So it's got this kind of slightly strange relationship with the EU. Is there pressure in Iceland to become a full member of the EU, or are people happy with the way things are, do you think?
There are different opinions. There's like one of the major political parties split into two, or what, like the, it's first and then like got a sub branch basically of the party with almost the same policies, except they want to go to the EU, so it's really the split.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not, it's probably 60-40 maybe.
Right.
No, yes.
And it's one of the big issues around fishing, because obviously if you were to join the EU, that would open up the fishing waters around Iceland to for other nations, and obviously fishing is a big part of the Iceland economy. So is that one of the big issues?
Yeah. Farming, yes, farming.
Right, okay.
Farming subsidies and all, everything around there.
And obviously Britain's going through Brexit at the moment. There is talk that the UK might join EFTA and be there alongside Iceland. Would you think Iceland would benefit from that, or would it not really make much of a difference?
I don't know. It's a numbers question, really. It's a numbers question rather than like something you and I can answer, I think. Economists and stuff like guys like that should answer, right?
And finally, do you think that it's a perception of Brexit as a good thing, or do people in Iceland not really have an opinion on it? Is it not really something which is played out here at all?
Bad thing because of how the pound just fell.
So I'm here in Reykjavik's Punk Museum, and your name is, sir?
Álvar.
I just wanted to get a sense of what the view of Brexit was in Iceland, because some people might say it's a kickback against the establishment, like some of the great punk heroes you've got on the wall here. Was it seen as a bit more self-destructive than that?
Man, I really don't care.
You really?
I really don't care. I think it's a big mistake to get out of the EU thingy, but everybody to his own.
Yeah. Really. And obviously Iceland's got a kind of weird relationship with the EU where you're in EFTA, so you have some of the rules, but not the others. I understand there's some people in Iceland who do want to be part of the EU. What's your view on that?
Well, I think we should go into the EU just because it's bigger.
So. Yeah.
But there are a lot of guys here who just want Iceland to be Icelandic and don't want the EU and all that things. And I really don't care.
So it's not much. It's not an issue because in the UK, Brexit, the EU, it's dominated the news for years, even before the referendum, right? But here, you guys, it doesn't really.
Nah, I mean, I don't know. I think that most of Icelandic people are not really political on it.
Yeah.
You know, they go vote, and then when it's finished, they just go home and drink a coffee and say fuck off. It's gonna be the same as the last time, so why bother?
So the sense from the few people there I spoke to was that Iceland doesn't really care too much about Brexit. It's quite happy and EFTA. There is a sort of a small pro-EU movement, but that would mean giving away control of their fisheries, which of course is a mainstay of the economy here in Iceland, especially since the financial crash of 2008. But it could be that we need to get to know Iceland a lot better. If we join EFTA, we'll certainly be the big boy in that group along with Iceland. So there'll be some tough negotiations there, and it might change the dynamics. So maybe we'd all be starting to get to know Iceland a bit more.
A little report from Iceland there. They didn't really care, did they?
No,
they didn't really care, did they, Ned?
No.
Was that a waste of time?
What, the honeymoon?
No. Or
the
interviews.
No, it's great. I loved it.
Yeah? Little punk guy?
Yeah.
You didn't care, did he?
No, he didn't care at all.
Well, there we are. Next week, Norway. No, not really. It's fine. Anyway, let's move on, shall we? Any questions about Iceland to anyone?
How much is a pint?
It's about £8.
Wow.
Norway, it's like £20.
Outrageous.
Wow.
Seriously, it's bad. Right, that's his quiz.
Okay, cool.
Okay, let's move on now, shall we, to UKIP. Good old UKIP. Under fire UKIP leader Henry Bolton claimed his controversial ex-girlfriend's leaked texts were doctored after being spotted having an intimate dinner with her just days after claiming their relationship was over. The anti-Brexit campaigner was seen giving kisses on the cheeks to Joe Marnie while the pair dined in the exclusive National Liberal Club in the heart of Westminster. In leaked text messages published early this week, Marnie reportedly said Prince Harry's fiancée Meghan Markle would taint the royal family, that she had a, quote, tiny brain, and that black people were ugly. She was also reported to have made comments about the sexual abuse of babies while discussing animal rights, messages which the UKIP leader claims were doctored. I spoke to him as I left the National Liberal Club, and he told me that she had been exploited by his political enemies, and the controversy over her remarks was beginning to fade away. Here's the clip.
The comments that Joe made that become public, many people found very extremely distasteful. Do you think that even keeping up a friendship with Joe undermines your position as leader?
I've said very clearly, I mean, what's happened in the last weeks or so has actually, I mean, it's starting to fade away now. There's going to be more news coming out tomorrow in relation to how some of this information was obtained, and the fact that some of it was doctored before it was published. This is fact. These are facts that are going to be out there in the coming hours. And I've said very publicly that, you know, although the romantic side of our relationship is now over, I'm supporting Jo and her family and trying to put things back together again. Absolutely. Because, you know, what's happened is that a young woman has been effectively exploited by my political enemies, who feel that they can't challenge me in open political debate on my leadership or my politics. And what I'd say to them is, you want to challenge my leadership, you want to challenge my politics, do it in an open forum, do it openly, do not do it covertly and exploit anybody in doing so. Because to do so is despicable, particularly the way they've gone about it.
And Miss Marnie, would you like to say anything in response to that, or you're happy not to? Okay, thanks very much, guys. Thank you.
It's a strange one, isn't it, Paul? I know that reading from your war zone this week, you're slightly waiting for someone to explain to you why her views.
Yeah, well, why should her views matter? She's not elected.
Yep.
She's in a relationship with a party leader, but there's no evidence whatsoever that Henry Bolton shares these racist views or these bizarre views about, you know, animals and child sex. There's no evidence whatsoever he agrees with it. So why is this even an issue? And it's an issue because they're such a tiny party. And it seems to be that everyone's saying, look, it's yet more evidence that actually he's a distraction. He can't get on with his job. But that seems to be the best case for why this is a story. I have to say, I do find it kind of odd, really odd, that he's being held accountable for something that's not his view.
It's a very old school scandal, isn't it? Text and stuff aside, man leaves his wife and kids for attractive glamour model. It's very tabloid, isn't it?
Perfect pictures for the papers, obviously, as well. And, you know, he answered the door, didn't he, when the son first exposed him? Yeah. He answered the door at her parents, and they couldn't believe their luck, the son.
Owen, obviously, this is kind of your area. Is the thing about this that they were looking for an excuse, as it were, to get rid of him, and this came up, and that's a reason, rather than it actually being about her views? Or is that part of it? No, that's completely right.
I mean, Bill Etheridge, who's one of the UKIP MEPs, who was, I think,
he's a sports spokesman, isn't he? Big front bench role.
Anyway, he stepped down, and he says, nothing to do with the personal life. I just think that Henry Bolton's rubbish as leader.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they were in an election a few months ago, and he won it, so clearly it's about the personal life. That's the kind of book they're doing it on. A lot of people think he sold himself as his family man, who's a safe pair of hands, and now he's done whatever he's done, but I mean, did he? I'm not sure he did particularly mention his family that much. I mean, he talked a little bit about it, but it wasn't his whole pitch. And you could, you know, you separate the personal from the political. I think the fact now is that, having said at the beginning of the week, the romantic side of our relationship is over, was the phrase that he used. Some people would say that it's perhaps not. It just leads to the idea of trustworthiness, I guess. If you're telling people the right thing.
So it's not the original thing anymore. It kind of builds into you could end up saying he's lying about whatever it is.
Exactly.
That becomes part of it as well.
But like I said, UKIP is so small now. Their membership is down below 25,000. They were losing 1,000 members a month. They've got no money. I mean, I've been told by someone in UKIP they can't even afford to have another leadership contest because it costs about £60,000, and they literally haven't even got that money.
If it's not him, who would it be?
Well, Anne-Marie Waters,
Will she be back in the frame?
She's left the party.
Right.
She left. She was the sort of Britain First.
And she is quite, like,
she is,
far
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
She's
she basically the, has the views. Yeah.
You can't get rid of one leader because his girlfriend's got far right rules, but then elect the one person that actually does have
them. But she's left the party now, so she couldn't have it. So, I mean, they're running out of it. I think you're up next, Ned, aren't you? To me, in a couple of weeks. I think Kate's doing it in sometime in June. So they really are running out of people. And the question, I mean, someone in UKIP even said to me yesterday, do you know what? I think it's over now. What is the point of the party? Mm. It's become so tainted. They work so hard, whether you agree with it or not, to get rid of their view that they're a party of racists.
Mm.
They obviously did a good enough job of that to get 4 million people to vote for them, because I don't think 4 million people in this country are racist. But now it's just their tentative grip on credibility seems to have just slipped away. It's annoying for some of us who've got a financial interest in UKIP keeping going, but there we are. Let's move on now to, in case you missed it, Miss Kate Forrester. You should be seated to my right. Hello, Kate.
Here I am. Very shooting stars, that. I like
know.
It.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah. Like Kate, with your face like a bag full of weasels.
All right.
Okay, sorry.
That was shooting stars. Yeah, exactly. Can I just point out he's not being very anti-Kate? Yeah.
What have you got for us?
So, this week, the Health Select Committee was hearing evidence from NHS Digital and from a variety of campaign groups who lobby on behalf of domestic workers and people who struggle to access healthcare in the UK. And they revealed that migrants, lots of migrants, are scared to seek medical help in this country. Because of a memorandum of understanding that the NHS and the Home Office has, whereby the Home Office can request people's personal data from the NHS in immigration investigations. So, one woman who works for Voice of Domestic Workers, which represents household workers, said that one of their members actually died because she had a persistent cough, was too scared to go to the doctor, had no idea what was wrong with her, just thought she had a cold that she couldn't shake off, and she died because she didn't seek medical help, which is obviously horrendous. And another, a GP who works for Doctors of the World, which is an organisation that helps people who struggle to access healthcare access it, says that they have scores of pregnant women coming to them who are too scared to go to the GP, too scared to go to an antenatal clinic or an appointment. Some of them are presenting to them in labour, having not sought any medical help whatsoever before then. And MPs, the MPs on the committee were sort of understandably horrified by this. and said, you know, this is literally a life or death situation. Why is this happening? The government's on balance excuse was that they're not trying to stop anybody accessing healthcare, but they have to balance that with having a robust immigration policy and the public interest around that. So that is quite remarkable.
So were
really.
These people, that the examples you've given there, were these people who were people who had the legal right to be here, or were they people who didn't have the legal right to be here, or were you not sure?
We're not sure. Right. I think some of them probably do, some of them maybe not, but obviously because of the narrative around kind of immigration and toughening up, toughening stances on immigration, even those that, you know, may be perfectly entitled to be here are worried about seeking help in case, especially with Brexit, I guess that's kind of magnified the issue as well. So it's really sad. Horrible story, really.
Yeah, absolutely horrible. Is there any suggestion from the MPs that they make any recommendations to the government? Is there work ongoing?
Well, they've asked for a proper breakdown of the numbers of requests that were made and how many of those requests have led to an actual sort of deportation or action being taken by immigration authorities. Because I think the MPs were concerned because they've been given a kind of overall number of requests that were made, but we don't actually know how many of those requests led to anything. And obviously the point that they're making is that it's leading to a breakdown in trust between clinicians and their patients as well, because obviously doctors have to tell people there is a chance that, you know, if the Home Office asks us for your details, then we'll have to give them to them. So obviously that is going to magnify an already quite serious situation, it seems.
Is this the representation that the what's actually happening when people talk about health tourism must be stopped and people coming here and abusing our NHS? This is the reaction to that, isn't it? So people feel they can't go and get health.
Well, it's the flip side of that, yeah. Isn't it? And obviously, some people would say, you know, to play devil's advocate, you know, if you're not here legally, then, you know, there are going to be consequences in your healthcare. You know, you need to be upfront about it. And, you know, as soon as anything looks remotely illegal, you need to declare yourself to the authorities and then everything can be sorted out. I think one of the problems has been that in some of these detention centres that people have been put in when they've overstayed, the conditions there are obviously not exactly wonderful. And a lot of people, whether it's parents with children, the coalition government and the last government tried to, thanks to the Lib Dems, tried to reduce that number. But I think that's part of the problem. A lot of people are just scared because they worry about what the consequences will be. But it's a really, really difficult debate either way.
Yeah, and I think there was actually a front page of, I forget which paper it was, the week, which was, you know, 2,500 illegal people coming here to have their children, kind of really ramping up that rhetoric. And I struggle to, I hope that even people who are very tough on immigration don't want people in this country, whether they're legal or illegal, to die because they're too scared to go to hospital or have serious health problems. Surely, you know, you can be tough, so to speak, on migration without people's lives being put at risk.
Still be humane,
you can be humane. Like, why not?
The problem is for the NHS staff who have to deal with this as well. That's what came out of that select committee, wasn't it? Their interest. They're not interested in illegal, legal. They're interested in the number one priority, making people better. And, you know, are they really now being turned into border guards, people in the NHS? That's the question.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for that, guys. Much appreciated. And we'll be back next week. What are we going to be discussing next week, Paul?
There's loads of stuff coming up.
Okay, right. Good. Find out next week.
Politics.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.